It's at 3:30 on a Tuesday afternoon, and time for the Tuesday afternoon Surviving the Future Book Club. Peter Buffett is with us again today. How you doing, man?
I'm doing well, thanks. You know, everybody's complaining about the cold. It's really not that cold, and it's December, by the way. So,
as we were talking about earlier today, meteorologists consider December, January, and February the three coldest months of the year, actual winter.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
while I was saying earlier today that it's the last Tuesday of autumn, it's really winter.
Yeah, exactly. I find that interesting, too. There must be a lag in, I'm sure a meteorologist could explain this to me, but, June 21st, December 21st, right? The solstice. But it takes a while for the atmosphere to catch up because it's always August and February that are really the killer months. So I don't know how that works, but...
Yeah, but your point is well taken. It's December. It's supposed to be cold.
Yep.
Right? I've been thinking... in these past few days that, mankind, personkind has been on this path for a long, long time, this path of evolving civilization, right? And
right.
a lot of the first communities and things that sprung up out of the need for shelter, for food, for procreation, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And they developed along a certain pathway.
Right.
And they've led us to this point.
Right.
What if they had traveled a different pathway? And is that possible? Could that possibly have happened?
That's a great question because everyone kind of has the demarcation of agriculture as the moment when things started to go south or whatever direction, which was about 10 or 15,000 years ago. Obviously, it didn't happen overnight. It took thousands of years to get into a true agricultural revolution. And that's when... quite understandably, and people wanted to get through the winter, get through a drought, get through whatever it was to have enough so they could survive. But then you end up invariably having too much, wanting to hold on to it, wanting to put a fence around it, getting an army, getting language to name it and quantify it. So all the stuff really kicked in around the agricultural moment, which was 10 or 15,000 years ago, or, in that frame. And yeah, what would have happened if when we had enough, we said, let's give it to somebody else or, let's plow it back into the ground or something. But instead, because we came from, I think, a consciousness of scarcity, like there might be not enough, our kids might not survive, we may not survive, let's hold on to it, let's hold on to more. We're still stuck in that mindset of we'd better keep hoarding because we might run out, and we're not going to run out.
No, and that's the part where our intelligence can overrule our biology.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah,
can overrule this vestigial attraction to an evolutionary past that just doesn't matter anymore.
But as I heard Elon Musk say not too long ago, our prefrontal cortex, our more developed part of the brain is still completely in service to our limbic system, which is the fear and all that stuff. And we haven't yet really developed, even though our brain has, we haven't kept up with it, actually. And we're still just a slave to the limbic system. And therein, I think, lies our potential for evolution as a species, really, is to say, wait, we're better than this. We can figure this out.
And I think part of that is finding different pathways and consciously following them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which sometimes may not be comfortable because of that historical past that's running
yep.
around in our cells, this
yep.
historical right memory.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we walk into a grocery store and our DNA has got to be going crazy because it sees all this stuff on demand. And that is very, very new for us. I mean, refrigeration is only 70 years old or so. So this is all new stuff.
Yeah. Which is a lot of what we talk about, or a lot of what David Fleming talked about in Lean Logic, and which Sean Chamberlain has distilled down into the book, Surviving the Future, the one that we've been presenting each Tuesday afternoon now for a couple of months.
Yep.
And, changing how we look at the path that we're on and taking a step off is something that's entirely possible.
It and necessary.
Yeah.
We better do it or else.
So we are now up to part three. It is titled The Path from Here to There. And part three begins with chapter 12. It's growth.
Part three, The Path from Here to There. Highly complex problems, which cannot be solved in a straightforward way and may not be soluble at all, are known as wicked problems. If we cannot see a solution, that does not necessarily mean that we have not understood the situation. It may mean that there isn't one. The main features of a wicked problem are vagueness. They lack clear definition because they spill over into many different issues and systems. Hard to grasp. They can be recognized from one or two perspectives, but are too complex to understand in the round. Populated. They affect many people. Solutions are likely to be social rather than technical. No right answer. The best that can be done is to pick the least bad response. Changeable. The problem and attitudes both to it and to solutions are constantly changing. No definition. The problem may be hard even to identify in a form that allows it to be shared. No solution. There is no objective, clear definition of the problem, so no definitive solution. And no clean ending. Problem solving ends when money or time run out. But do not believe that a problem is wicked because someone tells you so. Look again. Chapter 12. Growth. There are two relevant meanings of growth. One, the natural development of an immature system or organism to maturity. And two, a pathology in which a mature system or organism continues to grow. This chapter is about the pathology, an affliction of economics. Its presence has been felt in previous chapters, but now it is time to face it head on. As we have seen, as a market economy inexorably intensifies, driven by taut competition, the productivity per capita, per person, increases. This increased productivity must be reemployed in increased production, economic growth, to avoid unemployment growing towards hyper-unemployment, and eventually reaching a level at which maintaining any unemployment benefits would be impossible, since so few workers would exist to pay for them in taxes. In that scenario, anyone without a job would have no income, which in a market economy can be lethal. The critical rate necessary to avoid this scenario is about 2 to 2.5% annual growth in GDP. Little change since the economist Wynne Godley wrote about it in 1993. It cannot be too strongly emphasized that no recovery can be said to have begun until national production starts to grow faster than the economy's productive potential. That is, by at least 2 to 2.5% per year. Growth at any slower rate will not even bring the rise in unemployment to a halt, let alone turn it round. And it is per capita, per person growth in GDP that matters. To reabsorb those troubling advances in per capita productivity. Aggregate growth, i.e. a rise in total GDP, is of no value to the market economy, except insofar as it attends per capita growth. Rises in total GDP that are due to a growing population, e.g. from immigration, rather than to improvements in per capita productivity, will, of course, increase the government's revenues from tax, giving it more to spend on maintaining the ever-growing intermediate economy, i.e. on infrastructures such as transport, waste disposal, law and order, emergency services and administration. However, the demands made on those services will also be higher, owing to the larger population, so no one is better off, except perhaps some ministers who now find themselves with larger budgets, and the government, which can claim credit for a higher rate of growth, hoping that no one will notice that it's referring to the irrelevance of aggregate growth, rather than the per capita growth, which is a necessary condition for the stability of a market economy. This inherent need for eternal per capita growth will not go away. But of course, it is impossible to sustain it in a finite world, unless, that is, we assume a decline in the population at least as fast as the advance in productivity. And yet, once that path of growth has been trodden, if only for a short distance, it is difficult or impossible to stop. There is amplifying or positive feedback. Growth leads on to growth at a compound rate, And this evidence of success allows the myth of permanent growth to become established. However, any system which grows beyond its mature state without limit will, in due course, crash. It may not know it, but it is in danger. This is the central problem of the market economy. If it does not sustain its growth, it will collapse, because unemployment will rise without limit, and both private incomes and public finances will fail. And yet, if it does sustain its growth, it will collapse even more dramatically, owing to the depletion of fuel and materials, the breakdown of the soil's environment and climate, the costs and complications of its intermediate economy, and the decay of social capital. As soon as the society pulls free of its roots in reciprocal obligation and the culture in which it is embedded, and moves forward into the market economy, it is marching towards collapse. It is then bound to keep marching as the only way to postpone the reckoning. But the more successful it is in sustaining growth, the greater the ultimate crash will be. It is no individual's fault. It is not due to greed, to rising aspirations, or to lenders wanting their money to grow, though these may all jump on the rolling wagon of growth. Once growth has become established, it makes itself essential. It is certain that there are no simple answers to this, none that could be proposed without proposing at the same time a transformation in the whole of the way we think, work, and order our lives. But this is only one half of the story of growth. It is only the market economy that is under competitive pressure, both to maintain the advances in productivity and to keep practically its whole workforce employed. In fact, all previous societies have gone through the processes of growth, both per capita, advances in the productivity of labour, and aggregate through massive increases in population. With the end of the market economy in sight, it is worth reminding ourselves of the alternatives that history presents. Unlean alternatives to growth. Surviving the Future argues that the case for the lean economy is strong. It is a system that is clear about its intention. It invites original and exact responses. It learns from observation and feedback. It works. It has been proven. Resilient local communities will, by accident or design, find themselves drawn into a political and economic order which, in essence, is lean. And yet, lean is not the only social and economic order with potential for a time when the market is no longer with us. And there is a case for looking at another one with a formidable record, not only in terms of size, but also longevity. We are about to pay a brief visit to a form of society with resilience. Although recently, and maybe temporarily, in retreat, it endured for thousands of years, far longer than any other system of statehood in history. It is the political economic order which started to form, at various intensities and at various dates ranging up to 6,000 years ago, in, among other states, China, northern India, Mesopotamia, Persia, Egypt, Peru, and Mexico. They had a problem: water. Some of them received an annual monsoon, with a vast amount of rainfall over a few weeks, which often filled the rivers and caused flooding, while the rest of the year was dry and often very hot. Even if it rained, much of it evaporated before it could do anything useful, and evaporation kicked in hard as soon as forests were cleared for cultivation. Others had little reliable rainfall and depended on the flow of giant rivers, such as the Yellow River, which receives meltwater from the Himalayas, or the Nile, which carries water from tropical Africa. Or, to look at it another way, their problem was people. They could get by in a landscape with long periods of low rainfall and water being naturally conserved by forest if the population was low and the demands made on the land were minimal. A society that left it to nature to supply its meat, fruit, and vegetables saved itself a lot of trouble, and its people needed to work for only some 2 hours a day. But as populations rose, the only way of expanding the supply of food to keep pace was by irrigation and related infrastructures. It is not only the market economy that must grapple with the intensification paradox and the growth of the intermediate economy. That, to open it up a bit, meant that infrastructurally, they needed to build and maintain irrigation systems to supply the water, which became both more necessary and less available as they advanced into agriculture and felled the forests. And along with that work went the demands of harvest, storage, transport and distribution, and the various stratagems needed to make the best of less fertile soils, all supported by institutions of administration and government. And in conditions of abundant unpaid labour and no competition, the technical advances would have been of the intensifying kind, water management, domestication, eventually pulleys, rather than the labour-saving kind. The chief means of productivity advance was a massive increase in working hours. There followed a relentless growth sequence typical of intensification. More land and more labour is needed per person. At the same time, the population itself grows. When exponential growth becomes established, you quickly reach large numbers. But once these societies had reached the limit of what their land and water could support, they remained at that level for century after century, hovering above and below the threshold of subsistence. To support this population, water had to be diverted on, eventually, a stupendous scale. To supply irrigation systems stretching over, for example, the low-lying arid plains of China. But being low-lying, these regions were also exposed to floods, so it became equally essential to establish means of flood control. And floods, when they happened, could be apocalyptic. Not least because, as is characteristic of such preventive measures, the containment measures, when they failed, multiplied the problem. In 132 BC, the Yellow River burst over its banks and the dikes that had been built to prevent such an occurrence, sending a branch of the river across the plain and inundating whole regions. 150 years later, the whole river changed its course, finding a new path to the sea. Presented with repair operations like these, nothing could happen until the emperor himself got involved, with a supporting cast of thousands. And with such workforces at their command, it was only natural to knock off a few more dainty projects, such as the Grand Canal, 1,000 miles long, and the Great Wall, 5,500 miles long, and the pyramids. It would be possible to discuss whether such supergiant systems of irrigation, flood control, and water transport could be organized on the bottom-up, lean basis advocated in Surviving the Future. However, from what we know about the commons, about the scale of the hydraulic operations needed in these ancient empires, about the lack of earth-moving equipment other than men with spades, and about the death rates, it seems unlikely. Many of the criteria for a functioning commons, such as the need for local autonomy, for a shared sense that it is worth the attempt, for the task to be on a manageable scale, and for a good match between the amount of work that would have to be put in and the benefits that could be expected by the people who did it, are conspicuously absent in the case of the giant hydraulic schemes. Paybacks postponed for generations and probable death in ant-like armies of workers. These are likely not opportunities for which we should expect a rush of public-spirited commoners to sign up. In any case, bottom-up programs on that scale didn't happen. All the large irrigation systems were top-down projects involving extreme autocracy. These were regimes based on intimidation, reinforced by punishment. The Hindu law book of Manu sets out rules for the conduct of the ideal king. It commends punishment, the protector of all creatures, an incarnation of the law formed of Brahman's glory. Punishment is, in reality, the king and the male. Punishment alone governs all created beings. Punishment alone protects them. Punishment watches over them while they sleep. The wise declare punishment to be identical with the law. If the king did not, without tiring, inflict punishment on those worthy to be punished, the stronger would roast the weaker like fish on a spit. The whole world is kept in order by punishment, for a guiltless man is hard to find. Even the gods give the enjoyments due from them, only if they are tormented by the fear of punishment. Where punishment with a black hue and red eyes stalks about, destroying sinners, there the subjects are not disturbed, providing that he who inflicts it discerns well. It is not a bad king or a bad system that we have here, but a set of rules for how things should be. The Arthashastra, the Indian treatise on statecraft, recommends 18 kinds of torture, with the added recommendation that for particularly serious cases, they should all be administered on the same day. The central role of punishment was acknowledged by Confucianism, and the Chinese law code describes the instruments to be used to extract evidence. The Egyptian peasant who failed to deliver his quota of grain was beaten, bound, and thrown into the dike. The great cylinders of the Emperor Gudea of Mesopotamia, who reigned circa 2150 to 2125 BC, describe how he restored the Temple of Enninu after its neglect had afflicted the land with a drought. So extreme was the crisis and the action needed in response that normal life had to be put on hold. In fact, it was turned upside down, a vision of the impossible, like the lion lying down with the lamb in Isaiah. To quote, "He freed the prisoners. He remitted the taxes. A maid was in equality with her mistress. Her mistress did not strike her at all in the face. A servant walked in equality beside his lord. If a servant did wrong, his lord took no further thought thereof. The rod and the thorny switch he caused to be laid on one side, and the cudgel to be put away. Even the language of the whip was prohibited." The language of the whip. Not the ultimate sanction then, but normal communication. And along with punishment, of course, comes obedience. Among the Greek virtues, there is no mention of obedience. In medieval Europe, the knight was committed to loyalty to his lord, but not to total submission. But in the big civilizations of the East, obedience was central. In Mesopotamia, the good life was the obedient life. In Confucius's good society, the good subject was the obedient subject. And as for the masses, the small people, Confucius's code of honor did not apply at all. Their role was, like grass, to bend low in the wind, directed by the threat of corporal punishment and by the principle of mutualism, which punished the whole family for the disobedience of just one of its members. And your obedience had to be confirmed at all times. If you approached a superior, you had to kowtow, touch the ground with the forehead, and maybe kiss it too. A meeting with a representative of the pharaoh involved lying prone on your belly. And it got lonely, because if you were in trouble, no one would dare to come to your assistance. The Chinese historian, Sima Xian, who differed with his emperor's opinion on the abilities of a defeated general, was sentenced to be castrated in a darkened room. He wrote, "My friends did not come to my assistance. Those who were near and intimate with me did not say a single word in my favor." Into the room. Despite all this, the hydraulic civilizations were, and have remained, remarkably free of criticism. There were periodic revolutions in a sequence of sacrifice and succession. As dynasties became corrupt and decadent, the dikes silted up and the retaining walls decayed. But these were not challenges to the system itself. On the contrary, they renewed and strengthened it. They were integral to its resilience. As the historian Karl Wittfogel explains, criticism was directed not at the system, but at individual officials. Apart from mystics who teach total withdrawal from the world, these critics aim ultimately at regenerating a system of total power, whose fundamental desirability they do not doubt. And the reason was that those societies actually needed their giant construction projects, which in turn needed virtuoso administration. As Wittfogel writes, To say that the Masters of Hydraulic Society are great builders is only another way of saying they are great organizers. Was there an alternative? Well, yes, if you had the weather for it. You needed regular rainfall. Rainfall farming, being locally self-sufficient in water, has no role for a central authority to provide it. The authorities can provide other things, such as currency, a legal framework, and defense of the borders, but they are not indispensable in the way the governments of hydraulic civilizations are. If a state with rain-fed agriculture fails to carry out its duties, life will go on. If a hydraulic regime fails, then in due course there will be water shortages and/or catastrophic floods. Life will not go on. The people who endure that will want an effective government back on almost any terms. Unlean works. Areas with a rain-fed agriculture are the exception rather than the rule. If it had not been for them, with their freedoms to develop the market and their incentives to apply technology, there is no reason to suppose that the hydraulic states would have moved on from the autocratic but highly effective and resilient economic structure they had been developing and sustaining for the last 6,000 years. European freedoms, from this point of view, are the exception. As the anthropologist Marvin Harris writes, in anthropological perspective, the emergence of bourgeois parliamentary democracies in 17th and 18th century Europe was a rare reversal of that descent from freedom to slavery, which had been the main characteristic of the evolution of the state for 6,000 years. No one who detests the practice of kowtowing and grovelling, who values the pursuit of scientific knowledge of culture and society, who values the right to study, discuss, debate, and criticise, or who believes that society is greater than the state, can afford to mistake the rise of European and American democracies as the normal product of a march towards freedom. As for the Marxian view of history as the history of class struggle, Wittfogel comments, "Class struggle is the luxury of multi-centered and open societies." This leaves us with some reflections, unresolved. First of all, it is a reminder of how critical and vulnerable water supplies are around the world. In Western Europe, our ability to produce food is as good as the west wind, along with the higher latitudes, which can generally be relied on not to leave our crops unwatered for more than some 2 months at a time. This fragment of the song of a homesick troubadour appreciates this. "Westron wind, when will thou blow? The small rain down can rain. Christ, if my love were in my arms, and I in my bed again." Secondly, the lean, local, community-building, self-reliant response suggested for the multiple problems ahead seems to be a natural process of going back to our roots. It is where we came from. But the big hydraulic states of most of the world did not come from there. Well, originally they did 6,000 years ago, but even then it would have been at the level of the small settlements of the Iron Age, or the earlier Bronze Age, or even in some places the Stone Age. Farming without irrigation in those areas had to be on a very modest scale. They do not have rain-fed villages like Wymondham, Stanton and Laxton as models and inspiration. Thirdly, the government of a hydraulic regime would have no trouble in keeping economic output within the limits of zero growth. There was no pressure to keep surplus labour employed. They could simply be directed into a mega-project with a low survival rate, or the containing walls of some dikes protecting a floodplain could be breached. Or there was the well-established do-nothing option of allowing the surplus population to starve. Once it had been established, China's population and output fluctuated through a sequence of shocks and recoveries, but remained on average at about the same level for millennia. That's a steady-state economy. And of course, fourthly, this story reminds us to be conscious of some insecurity with regard to our freedoms. The hydraulic civilization's model of despotic government travels with conquest and politics. Wittfogel suggests that the Mongol invasion brought it from China to Russia in the 13th century, and that it was faithfully followed by another 7 centuries of Russian rulers, including Lenin and Stalin. Its origins are all about water. But once it is established, a political mindset develops a momentum, whatever the weather. The coming climacteric, with its energy famine, could supply authoritarianism with a regrettable opportunity to become reinforced in those parts of the world where armies of workers will again be needed to keep water flowing. And to then extend to those parts which still have hope of building a future on freedom and self-reliance. Environmental hazards are just the kind of threat, the enemy, which authoritarian regimes need. Green authoritarianism starts innocently, with sensible-sounding regulation, and then grows without limit. It has the advantage that it never has to be argued through, because it short-circuits straight to the begged question. You have to do whatever the government happens to want you to do today in order to tackle climate change. And if you make trouble, you are clearly an enemy of the planet. Green authoritarianism fails to activate citizens' intelligence and motivation. It refuses to recognize the decisive significance of local detail. It discards the potential of trust and imagination. It does not understand incentives. It presents environmental action in terms of adversarial politics, instruction, and surveillance. It is committed to the impossible task of protecting the status quo, rather than going along with the creative evolution of life. It lacks presence, and it is bad manners. It guarantees failure. Yet, faced with it, we may wonder if we know what we are doing. For the authoritarian state, character, moral courage, depth, resourcefulness, being capable of originality and surprise, not being easily destroyed by criticism or failure, is a nuisance, unpredictable and hard to seduce with cant. The state's task is, therefore, depersonalization, making people mild, dependent, programmable with imposed and universal principles. In the lean economy, by contrast, character will be built by slow prudence to make a mild people rugged. The idea of character is out of phase with a depersonalizing culture that places its confidence in process, technologies, regulations, rights, and the unchallenged guidance of economics. But it is central. A clue to it comes from Ralph Waldo Emerson in his essay, Politics. He is arguing in favor of small, lean government. And then comes this. Hence, the less of government we have, the better. The fewer laws and the less confided power. The antidote to this abuse of the powers of formal government is the influence of private character, the growth of the individual, the appearance of the principal to supersede the proxy, the appearance of the wise man, of whom the existing government is, it must be owned, but a shabby imitation. Followed by one of the most remarkable statements in the literature, the appearance of character makes the state unnecessary. Yet we should not forget that our brave and truculent insistence on local lean autonomy is, in some serious senses, taking on by far the biggest and most autocratic form of resilience that the world has ever known.
That's part one of chapter 12 of Surviving the Future, Culture, Carnival, and Capital in the Aftermath of the Marcus Economy. And Peter Buffett, one thing I'm so impressed by, of course, these writings have been edited by Sean Chamberlain from original work by David Fleming, is just how deep into history things go.
Yes, exactly. It's sometimes said that you can't know where you're going unless you know where you came from. And this is an example of that, and something I'm clearly obsessed with is history and trying to understand how we did get here. And I think he kind of buried the lead early on in this chapter, where he said the problem is people.
Which is sort of where it comes to at the end,
yeah,
with the Emerson quote about character. You know, government is not necessary as long as character is present, and that's kind of the thing I struggle with a lot of times when I talk to libertarians. Is they're like, I'm going to handle this just fine. You know, I'm going to be terrific about this. You know, the problem is other people won't be.
Right.
You know, we don't
yeah,
need,
exactly.
We don't need speed limits on that, well, because I'm going to drive the speed limit, but other people won't.
Other people won't. And the other thing about character is that the market economy has sort of co-opted the idea of character in the individual and tried to sell people how they can have character or be individual. So in other words, you know, instead of looking at it as sort of an ingrown, this is who I am for myself, for my intimate partner, for the community I'm a part of. The market has come in and said, here, you know, if you buy these shoes and you know, wear this and you do this, you're going to be unique. You're going to be special. And it's sort of like trading real character for just specialness. And it's a big difference.
Indeed. And you know, the idea that we look to what they describe as hydraulic civilizations, and
right.
We marvel at the Great Wall of China, and we marvel right. at the pyramids and right. the Grand Canal, but we don't, as noted in the book, criticize how they were made. I mean, there is, of course, we know that slave labor was used, but there's also sometimes an awe involved in
right.
in the end result, as completely overlooks how it happened.
Right, which gets to kind of growth and scale, because yeah, it's a really well described and laid out in the book how brutal it was and how authoritarianism is you know, how it was used, and it gets again back to scale, because the small hydraulic world, the world of mills and, you know, small grains and, you know, the various things that happened on a scale that was community based is one thing, one that is so dependent, as was described so well, on these massive infrastructure developments. I mean, it's extraordinary. Yeah, what was done. And yeah, we look back on that and just see the end result. We don't see the process of how it got there. I'm always curious because there was so much of an emphasis on water and what it's done to different cultures and societies and for how many thousands of years those were developed. You know, I think, and I hope I don't get in trouble for this, but, you know, Coca-Cola, I believe, is the single biggest user of water in the world, and it daily turns water into essentially poison. And someday that's going to be figured out. And the redemption in that is that they have an extraordinary distribution system. So if they can flip that script, you know, they could be saviors on a certain level. And at this point, what they're doing is taking the most precious resource and turning it into sugar.
Yeah, remarkable. The idea of how you manage water, too. You know, if you know that at the end of these 2 months, the drought will end and you're going to get enough rain to grow the crops that you need, you can trust in that process, right?
Right, right.
And the way that was articulated in this chapter was just fascinating, because the alternative is that the top-down authoritarian, they build the irrigation
right.
systems and they control it for you.
Right. Yeah, right. Exactly. The other thing I liked about this, and I really want to go back and listen to it, or may go into it more in the second half of the chapter, is the kind of illumination of what the climate change folks are kind of bringing into the mix of this sort of do it or die. He described it so well in the book, but to really recognize that climate change is an issue, but how it is taken to heart in a particular community is unique, specific, and certainly necessary. But there is this real top-down, like, do-it-or-else approach to climate change, which I believe, frankly, and we were talking about this before we went on the air, you know, I think that time has actually passed, and that we do have to look to community and regions to solve the issue specifically, although at the same time we're globally linked, so it's a struggle.
Yeah, and there is no harm in having plastic bag ban, as we have here going into effect in 2019 in Ulster County, or trying to maintain, you know, renewable energy and doing all that
stuff.
We're going to move that way anyhow. Mm-hmm. But there is a sense that climate change as a force is moving beyond our control, is moving beyond a statement from the governor yesterday saying that we're moving to a Green New Deal in New York State by 2040, which is 10 years past what the United Nations says we need to be moving towards. And the reality is that no one really knows.
No, I mean, and it's most likely too late. Not that the changes, like you said, shouldn't be made. They're critically important. But we're going to go through something. We're not going to get around it or under it or anything else. We're going to go through something. And, you know, when we look back 6,000 years or even 500 years, that I unfortunately think we have to look forward to, in those numbers as well. It'll be a process that we won't be around to see the end of, but it's going to be hundreds or maybe thousands of years to get to the other side of this.
It's Jimmy Buffett's Peter Buffett. It's Radio Kingston, 1490 WKNY, Kingston, New York. We've been airing audio chapters from Surviving the Future Carnival, Culture Carnival and Capital in the Aftermath of the Market Economy, with permission, kind permission, from Chelsea Green Publishers and from Sean Chamberlain, who has edited the book down, as I said, from the writings of David Fleming. Next Tuesday is Christmas Day, and the following Tuesday is New Year's Day. So we're going to reconvene in the new year for part two of chapter 12, which is the lean alternative to growth. So instead of growth for growth's sake, we're going to hear about an alternative to that.
And we should be thinking about that over the holidays.
We'll see you in a couple weeks, Peter.